Hello and welcome to A Little Less Conversation, a podcast series on how Australia is addressing climate change as a function of our international development program. I'm Rachel Mason-Nunn, founder of Goodwill Hunters and director at Mandala Partners.
And I'm Jessica McKenzie, chief of policy at the Australian Council for International Development, known as ACFID. This series is a special collaboration between ACFID, WWF Australia and Goodwill Hunters.
Climate change is the stormy undercurrent to our daily lives. Here in Australia, but in many of the countries we work in as development practitioners, it's a loud and urgent drumbeat. To do development effectively, it's increasingly, glaringly obvious that addressing climate change needs to be front and centre.
To that end, we're holding the microphone out to those willing to take on the sometimes vexed challenge of speaking to Australia's climate change and development goals, where they intersect and where they deviate, as well as profiling innovative themes and ideas. We want to see an Australia that is gearing up for action, with climate change being a central pillar of Australia's new international development policy. It's now about how to implement that ambition. We want to investigate the choices that will shape Australia's credibility in the global climate space.
You might have heard the term loss and damage lately. It's a concept that's increasingly the focus of global discourse on climate change. In short, victims of climate change lose a lot. They might lose their homes or their crops. Perhaps they lose all livestock in a flood. Maybe it's their traditional lands, their family cemetery, or the trees their family has tended to for years. Whatever it is they've lost, how can they ever be adequately compensated?
We're recording this just days after Australia announced an ambitious plan to resettle as many Tuvaluans as want to move to Australia. It's a laudable plan, but as we discussed in-house here at ACFID, our minds immediately went to the potential climate migrants themselves. It's great to offer them a new home, but how can they be sufficiently compensated for all that's been lost?
And that's where loss and damage comes in. The United Nations broadly defines loss and damage as the negative impacts of climate change that occur despite or in the absence of mitigation and adaptation. They can be both economic and non-economic. The former is quite easy to understand. It could be the loss of income from agriculture or having to rebuild infrastructure. The non-economic costs go a little deeper. These could be in the form of PTSD after a storm or the loss of community because of displacement.
To learn more about loss and damage, we've invited two experts onto today's episode. Julianne Richards is the strategy lead for the Loss and Damage Collaboration and has written extensively on loss and damage and campaigned with civil society on the need for loss and damage finance. We also have with us Melanie Pill, who is a research fellow at the Lowy Institute, overseeing the climate change portfolio of its Indo-Pacific Development Centre. She has extensive experience in climate change adaptation, mitigation, and loss and damage. She has also spent time consulting to regional organizations and governments in the Pacific. Julianne and Melanie, welcome.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Thanks for having us.
So loss and damage is a fairly new concept, and I, for one, find it a bit tricky when it comes to differentiating it correctly from some of the other terms that we hear in the climate change discourse. So, Julianne, if I can start with you, can you please elaborate on what we mean by loss and damage and what its particular features are?
Happy to, but I do think you did a great job in the intro comments, Rachel. So, as you said, you know, mitigation, reducing our emissions, stopping burning fossil fuels helps us avoid loss and damage. It reduces the global temperature rising and it reduces all of the impacts from climate change that we see. The next step along the spectrum that you can take is to adapt to the climate change that's happening. So one example might be, for instance, if we think of sub-Saharan Africa, if you're in an area where there's increasing droughts, you might shift the agriculture that you do to sustain yourself. Increasingly, there are examples where communities are moving outside of the field where you can adapt to. So they're facing climate impacts that are more and more extreme and can't be adapted to. So in that example of sub-Saharan Africa, if droughts become so intense and so frequent that we have desertification, i.e. land changes from being able to be arable agriculture land into land that is no longer able to be used for agriculture, then those communities face loss and damage. So as you said, you know, it might be the loss of arable agriculture, it might be the loss of fishing resources, if we think about the Pacific, with fish resources moving because of changing temperatures. and different ocean circulation. It might be damage from extreme storms, might be if you look at the extreme floods, for instance, in Dera, when the extreme floods broke the levee and flooded, you know, almost half a city away. The loss and the damage from climate impacts is what's facing communities now and will increase over time as well. So in essence, loss and damage is when we haven't done mitigation, we haven't done adaptation, and it's what we do to deal with those impacts of climate change that communities and countries are facing now.
Thanks, Julianne. That makes sense. There was a loss and damage fund set up in 2022, though, wasn't there? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes and no. So at last year at the climate conference in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt, there was an agreement that a loss and damage fund would be set up. But it was agreed by all countries, by the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, without any parameters. So yes, we would have a loss and damage fund, but what would it look like? Who would pay? Who would get money? What would they get money for? None of that was agreed. But they did agree a process of this year. A thing called the Transitional Committee was put in place. They've met five times this year. Their most recent meeting was a week ago. They've had workshops and invited, you know, a range of stakeholders in to talk to them. They've had dialogues. They've been high-level ministerial. So it's been quite a frenetic year to move from an agreement that we would have a loss and damage fund to the climate conference at the end of this year. What will it look like? Who will pay? Who will get money? And at that meeting last week, they did agree a package that will go to the climate conference and potentially be accepted or potentially be further negotiated as to what the loss and damage fund will look like. So at the moment, we have one in word only.
Bill, it sounds like a busy year. I'm going to ask, what's Australia's role to play here? So Australia's on the transitional committee. What does that mean?
Yeah, I think 20 members of the transitional committee off the top of my head. Australia was one. It was very highly sought after. So I said they had five meetings. Lots of transitional committee slots changed two or three times across those five meetings. So everyone wanted to be on the transitional committee, which was a good sign, high level of interest in the Loss and Damage Fund. Australia had a position and was attended every meeting. So Australia didn't have to share its slot. And at the beginning of the year, Australia said they wanted to be a Pacific voice on the transitional committee because there were no Pacific small island states. There were two Caribbean small island states on the committee. I think it would be hard to conclude at the end of this year that Australia lived up to that responsibility. So it actively argued against small island state positions. We can talk about a bunch of them, but, you know, for instance, it advocated for the World Bank to host the fund. It advocated for no scale to be reflected in the fund. It advocated for the fund scope to be limited, all of which were against small island state positions and against what Pacific Islands wanted. So I think Australia kind of failed on the bar it set itself at the beginning of the year.
Mel, what's your view on the fund and also on Australia's role in the fund?
Thanks, Rachel. So I just want to echo everything that Julianne said at the beginning about the setting up of the fund and the transitional committee. And you can really see that the interest in setting up the loss and damage fund shows the ambition to do something, but maybe also shows that everybody wants to have their say. And the discussions on how to set it up were incredibly political and going back and forth and stalled and actually collapsed at one point. We had four meetings scheduled, but we weren't able, or countries weren't able, to actually find consensus on anything. So they actually had to have the fifth meeting as an emergency meeting. So that just shows you the sensitivity of the topic, and that developed countries really are not happy in the first place to have a loss and damage fund. And we can talk about a little bit later about the political nature and the back and forth that happened with developed and developing countries. And yeah, just coming to the Pacific and Australia, it was definitely great to see Australia being represented on the Traditional Committee, especially because there's no Pacific voice on that committee, which was actually quite surprising because Pacific SIDS have a particular interest in the Loss and Damage Fund because they are currently really taking the brunt of climate change. Climate change for them is an existential threat. So we're even worse enough, drought-stricken areas in Africa, but for Pacific Islands, their home is on the line. And like Julianne said, Australia really had a chance to provide the Pacific with a voice, and they have also done that at the beginning when they still were part of the Green Climate Fund on the board. They were giving the Pacific a voice because research has shown, or voices have come through, that Australia is one of the countries that understands the Pacific. So countries from outside, even though they want to help and they want to implement projects, Australia is the country, and maybe New Zealand as well, here in our region, that really understands the Pacific and what works and what doesn't work. And that is partly because there's so many remote islands that people outside of this region cannot imagine how to reach them. And Australia just has that knowledge. So there was really a chance there to provide the Pacific with a voice that at the moment only has observer status. And unfortunately, that hasn't really gone as planned, although Australia still had a bit of a more flexible approach to the whole Loss and Damage Fund. But as I mentioned, the discussions were so heated and so fierce that there was really a dichotomy of discussions, a dichotomy of negotiations. And Australia then fell, I guess, more and more into a position that more aligned themselves with the position of the developed world. But we will see how it goes. Like Julianne said, the draft is there, but it doesn't mean that it can't be rewritten. It doesn't mean that some countries might not provide more concessions or make more compromises. So we'll see what happens at COP28.
I wonder if there's a more fundamental problem here, though, with the idea that it's anyone's responsibility to give the Pacific a voice when they have a voice and they clearly just weren't invited to the table in this discussion. They weren't given access to the platform, and so it became incumbent on Australia to represent the Pacific as they should. But why weren't they just there in the first place?
So the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, the COP, set up the Transitional Committee and allocated, I think there were 20 slots, and allocated them to various groupings. So the Association of Small Island States, AOSIS, of which Pacific Small Island States are a part, got two, both of them went to the Caribbean. I don't know, there would have been a discussion inside AOSIS how to allocate those slots. I don't know what that discussion was. So I agree, it was unfortunate, but UN politics and et cetera being like that. You can't have 170 countries on the Transitional Committee negotiating what it will look like. So you have to, and Pacific Island countries were represented at some of the meetings. So Fiji was on the Transitional Committee for some of the meetings, not the final meetings. They were there as observers at the end. So it wasn't, they were part of the overall AOSIS position making. It wasn't like they weren't being represented, but they just weren't sitting on the Transitional Committee the whole way through, which when you have 170 countries and a committee of 20, it's unavoidable that not everyone's going to be on it.
I just found it so interesting that a Pacific Island country wasn't represented when it just means really so much to them and were the ones that always advocated for the fund, fiercely fought for it. So I thought that was an interesting fact, even though, like you said, it's totally correct, obviously, that we can't have everyone on the Transitional Committee. And Fiji got the observer status, which definitely also gave them at least a little bit of a voice or being able to follow those discussions. And of course, there is AOCs, but I think a lot of people were really surprised that Pacific Island didn't make it into the transitional committee.
Even just the barrier of having the finances to be able to travel to these talks. And I know that you've both been present at these discussions. You've been able to physically be there and see what's happening, and that's so important. I have a question for you both. How do we fund a loss and damage fund? So my concern is there's such precious finances available for adaptation and mitigation, which are all future-facing, protecting for the generations that will lose unless we act. And I really want to make sure that we're not detracting from those very precious finite resources to make sure we have the funds for loss and damage. Is it an either or? How do we make sure we fund this correctly?
Super important question. Possibly one of the most important questions. We already don't have enough money for adaptation. We're not spending enough money to reduce our emissions and reduce emissions in developing countries. We're not spending enough money to help developing countries and communities adapt to climate change. We're not spending enough on disaster risk reduction. So there is absolutely no point. It would be counterproductive to take money away from those important pieces and put it towards the loss and damage fund. So the most important rule for funding going to the loss and damage fund is that it has to be new and additional. It can't be rebadged aid. It can't be rebadged climate finance, 100%. At the moment, now there's been very little money spent on loss and damage so far. At the moment, it has largely been rebadged climate finance. So it's basically adaptation. Instead of spending on adaptation, you spend on loss and damage, which is crazy. We go backwards when we do that. So that will be super important that that be agreed and that it be implemented. And we need, you know, where should the money come from? We need developed countries. So countries like Australia, rich, third biggest fossil fuel exporter. You know, Australia needs to be paying our fair share into the loss and damage fund. So Australia should make a commitment at the upcoming climate COP. I mean, Australia's made a commitment to the Pacific Resilience Facility, which is important and good, but we need to be coming to the table with far more money at COP for the Loss and Damage Fund. And we need other developed countries, other rich polluting countries to step up and do that as well. Other countries are invited on the current negotiated text that will go to COP are invited to contribute funds to the Loss and Damage Fund, and that's going to be important too. And the third piece, which will be really important because by the loss and damage collaborations estimates, we're going to need $400 billion a year for loss and damage finance. Now, that sounds like a lot.
Ooh, it does. That's a lot of money. $400 billion a year.
It is a lot, but it pales into insignificance when you compare it to, say, the money Australia is spending on subsidizing the fossil fuel industry. It pales into insignificance when compared to the money we spent on a COVID response, or even for those of us old enough to remember, the money we spent bailing out the banks during the financial crisis. So it's quite a small portion of all of those other things that we thought were important to spend money on. So we're going to need $400 billion a year. Most of that should go through the fund. And to get to that scale, we really should be taking a polluter pays approach. So we should be making sure that the countries and the industry that caused the problem of climate change, so that's going to be mostly the fossil fuel industry, are paying for the damage that they're causing. So at the moment, you know, they're digging up and selling fossil fuels. We're burning them. They pay very little tax, very little, and in some cases, no tax. And we need to change that. We need to internalize the costs.
Mel, how do you think we'd fund it?
Yeah, the polluter pays principle is definitely out there and also discussed at length, and different economic levers have been suggested. I personally like a tax or using the polluter pay principle and invoking or putting it on the biggest polluters in the world. Someone might ask, though, sometimes we think, oh, well, shouldn't we use that then for mitigation instead in order to avoid loss and damage in the first place? So that could be another way of looking at it. The one really important thing, and I totally agree with you there, Julianne, is that we need to stop subsidizing coal, which is really, if you look at the billions of dollars that are spent on subsidizing coal and completely distorting the price for it on the market as well compared to renewables, then we probably wouldn't even have to think about where to get the money from. If we just take those subsidies from one country alone, will probably be enough to fill that loss and damage fund. So and even provide finance for adaptation, which is also woefully underfunded. The latest report that came out is that it is 10 to 18 times falling short of what is actually needed. So yeah, fossil fuel subsidies are a big one. And I hope to see a lot of discussion on that at the COP as well. In general, also hoping to get something into the final text more concrete about really phasing coal out and really stopping those subsidies and not the loose language that we always see. But going back to creating a funding stream, so I did a little bit of research, and that might be quite innovative and probably not touched on a lot, is also looking into philanthropic money. There is a lot of money out there that is being spent, but not necessarily strategically. And also we're talking about private philanthropists. So we really would go into those billionaires or millionaires out there as well that made their wealth based on the current economic system we are in. So we could use that money. It's an untapped resource. It has been mentioned a lot, but never really investigated in depth. So we could have an engagement strategy. We could have maybe agreements with the philanthropic sector to funnel or channel funding into that loss and damage fund so that there will be a continuous flow on top of maybe the polluter pays principle that we also might use. And philanthropic money is not being spent strategically at the moment. It is spent on the person's interests. It is also, when it comes to the private sector, spent on mitigation because, again, it has a payback. But that's not what loss and damage funding should be about. It should be given freely for altruistic reasons, no strings attached, in order to feel that spirit of solidarity, which really should be the loss and damage fund. We want to recognize hardship. And so that is an untapped resource that I think we really need to investigate further.
And there's an increasing number of those philanthropics emerging on an annual basis too. So a growing pool.
Absolutely.
If you will.
Yeah, no, and they're really interested in acting on climate change as well. It's not that there's no appetite. So data has shown that there is growing interest and also growing spending. But if we could have that strategically through the UNFCCC, that would be an amazing opportunity.
So obviously the mechanics are still being figured out and there's a lot to be decided, but how do we design for integrated approaches that will include water, energy, food, and environment? How do we go about that?
This is tough, Jess.
Do you have the answer?
I have an answer. I can say that whatever is in this loss and damage fund, however it's going to be designed, it needs to work for the most vulnerable countries and the ones that are affected the most. So I think this is something we really need to keep in mind, that people that, or countries that haven't, caused communities, actually, we're talking about communities on the ground. We're not talking necessarily countries. We're talking about people here suffering basically from the politics and from the discussions at the very highest level. And we're forgetting that we actually have to serve the communities and the individuals in those countries. So I think that we need to take that into consideration. And I think we need to think about a context-specific approach, that there is enough flexibility for countries to spend the funds on that they think they need to spend it on, rather than the developed world or rich nations, wealthy nations, or whatever you might want to call them, having the control over what the funds can be spent on. So if we have a country where water resources are scarce, then they should be able to spend it on water resources and in a way that works for them. So not someone stipulating, I think you need water tanks, but that is actually not the way it works in that context. So the communities themselves, and sometimes, yes, unfortunately, it goes down to the communities. This is how complex this issue is, similar to adaptation. They need to decide themselves what works for them and be able to spend that money flexibly. And if they want to spend it on restoration of cultural heritage or biodiversity, because it is important to them for their lives and livelihoods, then they should be able to do that. So those addressing those non-economic losses. So I think that's what the Loss and Damage Fund should also consider, rather than making a priority for water, for forests. So depending on the country's needs, they should be able to use that money flexibly and decide.
Mel, can I just follow up on that? I read a piece that you wrote for the Lowy Institute where you said that climate change-related legal cases have more than doubled since 2015. And what's the role of litigation in the context of loss and damage? And is litigation what it will take to actually spur action?
I think it definitely puts a lot more pressure on the governments around the world. And we're seeing them being increasingly successful. And I do believe that there might be more successful cases in the future, not through climate courts. We don't really have that, but through other avenues like the International Court of Justice, for example, the International Law of the Sea. So there are all clauses in there that might be able, where countries that have done little to what is happening and to climate change might be able to use as avenues to create those cases. So I think it would put more pressure on the most the highest emitters, and might actually end up in more cases being more successful. I do want to mention, though, some of my research also looked into compensation of whether it's desirable or not, and actually talking to communities and people on the ground. And some are not so sure whether compensation payments as such, like a check that compensates you for the loss of a loved one, is actually the most appropriate way of addressing the losses and damages or the non-economic losses that were caused by the impacts of climate change. So while this might be a call from countries, it might not necessarily be something that people on the ground would like to see, or policymakers see as something feasible or desirable. So that's one thing that maybe is also important to mention.
I mean, of course, it sounds incredibly crude and insensitive to think of compensating someone financially for the death of a loved one, but what alternatives did we have? Like, in your conversations with communities, did they suggest other options that would be preferable to that sort of compensation?
Yeah, some people expressed that there might be some alternatives to that that are not necessarily just a payment in order to replace something, but to provide opportunities, for example, job opportunities, lifting people out of poverty. I remember one person mentioning that they had to discontinue their studies overseas because the hurricane that devastated their homes forced her to come back, and what she wasn't able to study her degree anymore. So those fees were basically lost. So having compensating for that, and that would be one option. Also, leniency with mortgage payment was something that came up, because people lose their houses and they still have to pay the mortgage, for example, but they don't have a house anymore. So these are sort of alternative ways of maybe compensating people and making their life easier, or just putting it back on track.
I think it's maybe worth noting that the idea of, you know, a check because your loved one has died has not at all been discussed in the Loss and Damage Fund. And I don't, I guess there's two aspects to it. As Mel was saying earlier, super important that the Loss and Damage Fund is driven by country needs. So it needs to be directly accessible by countries, needs to be directly accessible by communities as well. And at the moment, that's written into the text that's agreed. And countries needs to be nationally determined. So countries, as Mel said, know what works best for them. They need to put in place plans that, you know, they've determined what works for them. Maybe there's another body that's being set up called the Santiago Network for Loss and Damage that's being set up in the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. And the idea behind that is that it works with countries, it provides them with technical support to work out, well, what are our loss and damage needs? How do we develop a plan? You know, all of this is quite new. Things are moving very quickly. And they would put their plans forward to the Loss and Damage Fund. So it needs to be nationally driven. But the idea of like a compensation check hasn't come up, and I think you would struggle to read it into what's been agreed so far.
I'm going to ask you both about what this fund looks like and where it's housed. So at the moment, there's been a lot of conversations, including in early November, where a group reached the final point in a negotiation and it was agreed that this might be housed by the World Bank. Julianne, can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Absolutely. The current text that will go to COP that the Transitional Committee has negotiated says that it will be housed in the World Bank on an interim basis. So interim being 4 years. And it has a number of conditions. So they're very good conditions, and a range of people would be surprised if the World Bank can meet them. There has, as you said, there's been lots of controversy about whether the World Bank should host the Loss and Damage Fund. And that's for more reasons than we probably have time for today. But some of the top ones are that the World Bank is very much run by a donor-driven basis. So it doesn't, you know, we've been talking about the importance of the Loss and Damage Fund being country-driven and community-driven and needs-based, and that is not how the World Bank works. It's very top-down, you know, donors decide what they want to spend their money on, and that is not how the Loss and Damage Fund should work. Secondly, the World Bank, the business model of the World Bank is of loans. So the World Bank primarily provides loans. That is 100% not appropriate for loss and damage. You know, if you think about what the Loss and Damage Fund is doing, in many instances, a country will have taken a loan to build infrastructure, which has then been wiped out by a super typhoon, stronger than anything we've ever seen before because of climate change. They then, according to the World Bank method, have to take a second loan to rebuild that infrastructure, and this will continue ad nauseum. And this is why many countries that are vulnerable to climate change impacts are in debt distress. So we have a really high proportion of countries on the front line of climate impacts in debt distress, with extremely high levels of debt, paying more for debt repayments than they can afford to pay for education or health. If the World Bank continues its business model, we would just continue down that horrific pathway. But And there are other reasons. So the World Bank uses intermediaries, which adds costs. The World Bank is incredibly expensive to use. And, you know, it builds in costs at every opportunity, flying business class, staying in posh hotels, et cetera, et cetera. So I would say that, you know, there are many reasons why the World Bank is not appropriate. And it has to be noted here that Australia was advocating for the World Bank to host the Loss and Damage Fund. Alongside the US and the
Can I just follow up a few points then? Just as a former World Banker, just to play devil's advocate a bit. In the Pacific Islands, the World Bank gives a lot of grants, not loans. So there's a number of Pacific Island countries that aren't receiving World Bank loans. So there is a mechanism for grants. And is the bank not capable of working more locally? Like, I think like everyone else in our sector in recent years, they have made concerted efforts internally to shift their approach to working locally and challenging that very top-down approach. It's certainly in their interest to do that and to be able to work as locally as possible. So I don't know. I understand the legacy of the bank is working in quite a top-down, donor-driven way, but are they not capable of working in a different way, given that that's what loss and damage requires?
I think lots of people are highly skeptical. And the conditions that have been written into what the Transitional Committee agreed, the package they've agreed that will go to COP, addresses a number of those things. So that, you know, basically all the elements except for debt that I was talking about, we can come back to that, that you've referred to are in there in conditions. So the World Bank has to be able to deal directly with countries. That's one thing that they currently don't do. They always work through intermediaries. They have to be able to deal directly with communities. So communities have to have direct access to the Loss and Damage Fund. Their fees have to be reasonable. I mean, there's so much wiggle room in that word, but and it needs to be country driven. So there's a whole bunch of really good conditions in there. If the World Bank and it says the World Bank needs to reassure the board, which hopefully will be elected immediately following this COP, that it can meet those conditions ahead of it being appointed the host. So hopefully, well, if this package is agreed as is, and the World Bank agrees to meet those conditions, hopefully it can live up to them. Most developing countries, in fact, I think all developing countries. So this was the one issue that really clearly, there are a number of issues that clearly divided developed and developing countries, but this one did. All the developed countries were on the side of the World Bank hosting it, and all the developing countries were on the side of it being an independent organization. And I really think that tells you all you need to know about the engagement, you know, on Loss and Damage Fund and the World Bank. So I think it's very suboptimal if we agree that it's, you know, if countries agree that it's in the World Bank. I think they may, because it's in this draft package. But there are very good conditions in that are set right now. But it will be very, very important that the World Bank live up to those conditions, that civil society monitor them, make sure they live up to them, that countries are kind of really keeping a close eye on this. And the other criticism, and I'm sure Mel has things to say here, so I'll end on this point, is that the World Bank has set up and been set up as an interim body before, and it has never stuck as interim, as in there is no end. Once you're in the World Bank, you are in the vortex, and there appears to be no way out. I'm not aware of any examples where a fund has gone from being in the World Bank to being outside the World Bank. So there's two examples, but particularly the CIF funds, the climate investment funds that the World Bank runs. I think we're 11 years beyond when they were supposed to stop running those, and it's still being run by the World Bank. So there's just, once you're in the vortex, you're in, is the concern from, you know, all bodies.
I think there's competing views on this one, and we could spend the whole episode talking about it. I can tell that Melanie needs to come in on this question as well. I am going to ask you both, though. I understand it's an interim arrangement. Everything I hear from the Pacific when we're talking to Pacific partners is about expediency. And a new fund would take years, and the World Bank is set up and could get this up and running in 12 months or so, really. So isn't there I presume that was a part of the conversations in Abu Dhabi. I imagine expediency is very high on the priority list given the urgency of some of these impacts. And I also have rarely heard the Pacific speak with one voice. So I'm fascinated by all the different people who would probably have opinions on this, and I wish I could have been in the room myself. Melanie, did you want to respond to that?
Yes, I would love to respond to that. So just to echo a little bit what Julianne also said, the World Bank is a lending institution, so they're not really made up of, although they can provide grant-based finance, but that's not their core business. It's a bank. Let's just face it. Like I mentioned, it doesn't really meet the spirit of solidarity that loss and damage should be about. Also, the World Bank is missing safeguards and gender, which is not addressed. Gender, for example, which is addressed through the UNFCCC, and we're making sure that vulnerable groups are more protected than others. And we are currently have a looming debt crisis. It's not just one country. We're having many, many countries that are facing a debt crisis. So that would actually worsen that as well. Just want to echo that as well. And the terms that we're talking about really need to negotiate it with the World Bank, and they need to agree to that. So is that really something that's going to be faster than setting up a new fund? And then how many concessions do developing countries then have to make? Yes, it's in the current draft text, but that is only going as a draft. That doesn't necessarily mean that everything that is in there is going to be agreed on. And having the World Bank as an intermediary, even if it's just for 4 years, we don't know whether that is actually then going to, whether the World Bank is then at one point not going to be the intermediary anymore in 4 years' time, because that would mean then set up a new fund, right? And then we're at the same problem as we are now. So I'm not sure how then that is different in 4 years' time, unless maybe there's work parallel happening of setting up a new fund while the World Bank is the intermediary. So I'm not sure where that argument of speed is here. Another option that was also suggested, which has gone to the sidelines a little bit because developed and developing countries were very much clashing on the issue of the World Bank, is the Green Climate Fund. I'm not sure whether that might still be an option, but it's definitely worth looking at whether there is a board set up, a secretariat, negotiations can happen straight away. Maybe there could be a sub-fund, something like the EU Solidarity Fund, something that works on similar architecture. So the EU Solidarity Fund, for example, has a cap on payments for certain loss and damage that was caused. It has a needs-based allocation mechanism. It is based on the country's GNI, or we could maybe use GDP, which means that emerging economies would find it very hard then to access funds from the Loss and Damage Fund, which was also a point of contention, that it really should go to the most vulnerable and the least capable countries to deal with those losses. And then potentially other aspects like sea level rise, like slow onset events, could be integrated in that as well. So it could be modified, but using that maybe as a role model or as a guidance to set up a loss and damage fund, and then using the administrative arrangements of the Green Climate Fund might be an alternative if we want to get away from this really clashing point of the World Bank.
Very interesting. I think we could probably do an entire episode, probably an entire series actually, on the role of the bank in loss and damage. So we'll park that for another time. It would be remiss of us to not talk a little bit more about the Tuvaluan example, which is very live, as Jess said at the start of the episode. We're recording this just a few days after what is a reasonably landmark agreement between Australia and Tuvalu. It would be good to get both of your views on that. And I'm particularly interested in the more practical elements of this agreement and how you see that playing out.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really new thing that came up. And really, I have to say, I was quite surprised of that decision or of that announcement. But I do agree this is a milestone. This is something that is unprecedented, that no country has offered yet. So that comes really offering countries a pathway out of the impacts from climate change when it is existential for some. So I think that is it is a major achievement. In practical terms, we will have yet to see how that is going to work out. And I don't think this is going to be easy, but this is a huge step forward in the right direction.
I think for me, the agreement that Tuvalu and Australia reached, it's certainly a step forward from Kevin Rudd's suggestion a few years ago that Australia would accept Tuvaluans if we got their fishing rights, which was ugly. But I noticed that Pacific Islands Climate Action Network reaction seemed to really turn around the fact that Australia is not taking any efforts at all to reduce its fossil fuel mining in particular and exports. And use, really. And I think this is quite important in the loss and damage debate, in the loss and damage issue. We absolutely have to address loss and damage because people are facing it right now. Communities are facing it right now and dealing with the impacts of climate change that they did not cause, and they need support. At the moment, the people funding loss and damage are the poor and marginalized people on the front line of impacts. That is not fair. That has to change. But we can't address loss and damage on its own. We absolutely have to stop burning fossil fuels. We need to stop digging them up. We need to stop selling them. Otherwise, we will face more climate change than we can possibly fund through loss and damage. you know, or fund through adaptation. So it needs to be seen as a package. Australia needs to stop relying on fossil fuels, needs to stop subsidising fossil fuels, as Mel said earlier. And we need to support our neighbours like Tuvalu, like Kiribati, Fiji, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we need to be a better player in the region.
I think I had a similar reaction to the announcement, and I'm all about practical and realistic policy. But I think one thing I felt was just a bit sad that we've reached the stage where we're planning for countries like Tuvalu to be abandoned. Like it felt, I think when I read it on the weekend, I sort of had a moment where I went, oh, wow, like we're here. This is like, okay, we've reached this stage where we have to plan like this. And I think that was sad. And I think, as you both said, these sort of very necessary short to medium term planning agreements are absolutely vital, but it can't disincentivize us from still trying to mitigate and transform industries and economies where we still can.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. It kind of hit me as well. It's like, oh my gosh, we have reached this point, this unthinkable point of having to provide refuge to countries that at one point might not be on the map anymore. And now in moving forward, there are going to be a lot of issues in drafting that loss of sovereignty. How are we going to deal with that in terms of a government, community? So yeah, so many issues, and it really hit me as well that we have reached this point, that this is something that is actually necessary.
Thank you so much for your time today, Julianne and Melanie. We've been Jessica McKenzie and Rachel Mason-Nunn on the A Little Less Conversation podcast. Tune in again. Thanks again. Bye for now.